This is on, is there any other way for the non-grasping mind than being abiding in Brahma-viharas or jhanas? It is said that the metta leads to jhana and jhanas lead to equanimity. And what are the relationships between jhanas and the Brahma-viharas? Although abiding is not the very, very proper word for this is not the illusion of somebody abiding. I use it as it is in the Metta Sutta, sublime abiding. So this, like the jhana factors are developing the factors to get over the hindrances, like the jhanas are all positive and the hindrances are negative. So you have the hindrances which holds you, that keeps your mind in a state of where it never, you can't concentrate it because the negativity is so, tends to like doubt and restlessness and dullness and anger and lust. Of course, if those are active in the mind, then you can't have any kind of real concentration. And so once the jhanas are ways of say developing or relinquishing, like with vidukkha vichara, the more or less the contemplation of it, and putting, learning to sustain or hold attention on to something positive, like with the metta practice. You have to use a lot of, it's vidukkha vichara really, is what you're doing. You're sustaining or holding your attention on the concept of metta, loving kindness. So if you keep sustaining and thinking about loving kindness a lot, then that will suppress the negativity. Or some people get negative about loving kindness. But that's also to be seen, to recognize that sometimes the idealism and that will bring up negativity. So if it's important to see, like to allow negativity into your consciousness and letting it go, rather than just suppressing it. Like I did this experiment one time when somebody's teaching, talking about loving yourself and how everybody should love themselves. And so this kind of phraseology I found kind of irritating. It all sounds so kind of, embarrassing and wimpy, wet kind of thing. So I think I love myself, and some of the cynic in me kind of resists it. So I'd take this, I'd say to myself, I love you. And then I'd watch the emotional reaction come up. There would be maybe, I'd feel, oh, I don't like this, but I'd watch, I'd go to the actual feeling of it, the kind of embarrassment or the aversion, intellect or emotional aversion to that statement. And by doing that, eventually I could say it where no aversion would arise. If you just keep, it's like using something to, you're not trying to convince yourself that you love yourself. You're using the concept in order to bring up the, say, if you have a particular problem like this, I found it very helpful to use it in order to acknowledge the negativity, say, that the kind of, the cynical tendencies of the mind. Or the kind of that kind of negative reaction one has towards maybe thinking it's too soppy or sentimental or whatever, but the aim to not convince yourself, but to just watch what happens. And then by doing that, by allowing the negativity, by acknowledging the negativity in consciousness, you can let it go. And after a while, I could say, I love you, and no negativity would arise. Try that sometime if you have. I mean, because recognize in the Dhamma, you're learning how to work with your mind. You're not trying to convert. You're not trying to convince yourself that Buddhism is right and that you should love yourself and that, you know, we're not trying to, you know, it's not trying to make you agree with us and to become a Buddhist, but all the teachings are there in order to liberate your mind. And of course, you're not going to liberate your mind if you just grasp the teachings and adopt the teachings. A kind of just a kind of blind belief that everything the Buddha said was right and Buddhism is best and a kind of party line Buddhist. That's not going to liberate you. It might make you kind of committed to an institution, but it's not going to liberate you into Nibbana. Then Brahmaviharas, or in jhanas, you see the rapture and sukha, happiness. So that as your concentration increases, the vidakka vidachara, the kind of contemplation, thinking, and sustaining, that drops out, and you feel more just the sense of rapture or a good feeling, and then mental happiness. Eventually, the rapture drops away, and then there's the happiness, and then there's the upeka or ekagata, or kind of the clear mind, the mind that is just has clarity. There's no, one isn't clinging to happiness or to a kind of good feel, physical feelings or raptures or. One isn't trying to get that or sustain that or hold on to it. And in the Brahmaviharas, the fourth one is upeka, which is equanimity. And metta and upeka are both paramitas in the 10 paramitas. They're the last two paramitas. Like metta is very much how I see it is, it works very much on developing a non-aversion. But you're still thinking, you're still, but you're using thought without being critical. Like you can have metta for, like using metta for yourself or your anger, or maybe bad feelings or bad mood or whatever, you can have metta for it, which means that you acknowledge it's there, but you don't react to it with aversion. You're willing to feel maybe the bad mood you're in, and then that's a kind of, that's metta, you know, loving kindness or a willingness to accept something for what it is. Practice with yourself, you know, this is what it means, practice with yourself. To be able to learn how to accept maybe the unpleasant state, mental states you have, or physical feelings, or illnesses, pain, all that's painful, unpleasant, both mentally and physically, metta is a very useful form of meditation, because it's not saying it. You like it, or I mean, it's a way of developing, of accepting something and not proliferating with aversion, not creating aversion onto it. So, like something unpleasant, usually we I don't like it and get it out of here, isn't it? If we're just reacting to something ugly or painful or unpleasant, we tend to just the natural reaction the reactiveness is, I don't want it, get it out of here. And then the metta practice is a way of accepting something that is ugly, painful, unpleasant, for accepting it for what it is, without following this reactiveness. You're getting beyond just the reactiveness, the habitual reactiveness, to noting it, to accepting it for what it is. It's just what it is. It's not yours, as you're seeing the anatta of it. A bad mood is not, you're not saying my bad mood, or I'm in a bad mood. It's, there is this, maybe this mood. And then there's a willingness to accept it for what it is. And that's practicing metta towards your own, say, unpleasant mood. You see, so it is, you're aware of it, you're acknowledging it, you're not calling it anything, you're not saying it's mine, or you're not blaming anybody, saying it's your fault that I'm in this bad mood. Or anything, you're just, it's like this, this is the way it is, it feels like this. And with a kind of forbearance and patience and non-aversion, say, then the metta is like that. Then it can be more, then metta can go into more kind of positive, rather than just remaining more non-averse, it also can go into more a kind of, sending blessings and goodwill and all that, but towards yourself, mainly. I found it more useful to think of it in terms of non-aversion and patience and acceptance of something that maybe you don't like about yourself at all, and then you can resolve that. Resolve those negative emotional reactions to it. Then upekkha is equanimity, and that's an ekagata in the jhanas, ekagata upekkha. The mind is just clear and balanced emotionally. There's not emotional things going on. So there's just the kind of equanimity and clarity of conscious experience. Remember in the Western world, we tend to be annihilationists, suppressing things. So I mean, the developing the jhana factors, like jhanas are sometimes, people have very strong opinions about you should get the jhanas or not get the jhanas, and different people have various interpretations and that of this, and according to what they read or the way they practice, and so that it gets very confusing for people who read the books, and somebody will say you should get first jhana or fourth jhana or whatever, and some people make a lot out of this about getting jhanas, and other people have strong views that you shouldn't get them. And you get stuck in them, and goes on and on like that. But the thing to do is to watch your own opinions and views or doubts about it. These things come quite naturally. They don't grasp the concepts of them too much, because this is a natural process that takes place. You're not particularly trying to get the jhanas as a kind of personal achievement. And that's where oftentimes the Western mind is, it wants to feel, you know, I've got the jhanas now, they grabbed stream entry or something like that. I'm a stream enterer, and it's And to me, the whole point is when people start talking like that, I know that they're, you know, they're deluded, because that isn't the way it works. You don't become a stream enterer. And if you want to get the jhana, you maybe get something that you call jhana, but it's still fraught with a sense of a personal attainment. And people get very opinionated and zealous about these things. People get very strong views. Whereas, say, in the reflective side of Dhamma, you see that if you've got strong views, you know, you've got to get the jhanas, it says so in the suttas, and what you can know is that, you know, is something in your mind, that the feeling of having to get something you don't have is this way, or just the way the mind will attach to the perception, to those perceptions. Then you can, if you keep to that level of reflection, then you that integrates and that works well in every way. So that, because like in the jhanas are really a relinquishment of the more coarse levels of concentration to the refined, so that it's not an attainment, it's more of a relinquishing, a subtle relinquishing. So you're not, so, but one thing I found that to really see that to notice happiness and to rapture and happiness, pitti and sukha, but not to attach to these things is something, you know, like wanting to be happy and rapturous. But when these experiences do come, note them. Like piti or rapture is more or less like a kind of physical, almost a sense of fullness and it's not rapture like kind of ecstatic feeling, but it's a subtle sense of well-being and that's quite physical. And then sukha, happiness, is more mental. And I realized that happiness was something I tended to dismiss. I've always regarded it as not worth bothering with. So there's this kind of dedication to dealing with dukkha, suffering, and the feeling that happiness is not particularly anything worth giving two seconds to. But these are like, it's brightening and gladdening the mind and the body, and you're bringing in your whole the physical, the mental existence into positive feelings, which are conducive to which are levels of concentration. But you're not seeking that like in as an end in itself. That is just like an exercise or a way of developing mental training, so that your mind has a flexibility and adaptability to reflect on the Dhamma, because that's where you'll find liberation. You don't get liberated through the jhanas. You do through the Four Noble Truths. Some people want very much to have happiness as a result of their meditation, just to sit and get happy and get high, get rapturous or blissful. And that is you know, it's all right, but it's not, it's inevitably going to be disappointing. Because this realm we're in is not, doesn't allow for any kind of sustained happiness in it. It's not this realm of the senses. It's basically a realm of unsatisfactoriness. So it's just not, it's not a place to seek happiness as an end in itself. And so the Buddha was teaching a way to use the existing conditions of our, of this sensitive state for liberation. And just seeking happiness is not the way. Even though happiness is nothing to be despised or rejected, it's not a worthy goal in itself, because it will only be a disappointing one. Even if you get happiness, you lose it. And so the happiness of Nibbana is called the highest happiness, is different than Sukha. The fact that it is the happiness of knowing the truth and not being deluded. It is that sense of relief, more a sense of like of relief and peace and knowing the truth. Absence of fear, absence of anxiety, and non-grasping. Now that is then, that isn't a condition, that is the way things are when there's non-grasping. So Nibbana is a realization of ultimate reality. It's not a condition that you create with your mind, where happiness, the sukha, is. Sukha is dependent on things, you know, supporting it and allowing it to be there. But the Nibbana isn't dependent on conditions. Whether things are going well or you're healthy and life is wonderful or it's terrible or whatever, has no effect on Nibbana, realization of Nibbana. In getting to know yourself, then you know where your kind of weak points are, it's very important for you to know this, for you to study yourself and observe. That's why we reflect, we notice what happens. Not as a criticism of ourselves, but just to know where we tend to fall apart, where we lose it, where we get lost. And then you can, once you know those points, then you can work from there. Once you see where the flaws and the weaknesses are, then you can go to those. You're aware of where to put your, you know, there's a lot that is strong and healthy and goes well. Then there's those points where that are weak spots. And it's not like a, it's not, you know, we tend to be critical of ourselves for having them, you know, thinking that we shouldn't have them, that we should be, you know, strong and all the best. And then we can feel quite critical and averse to ourselves for having these. But that's silly. I mean, we all have to learn to say, I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, and so forth. We have to work from what we have. None of us are given the best. God doesn't give us the best. He gives some people some pretty inferior material to work with, too. Some of the people, you know, that really oftentimes have great disadvantages born with a lot of handicaps. They're the ones that learn the most from life. And some of the people that, you know, have everything, you know, the best, good health, appearance, beauty, wealth, easy life, they don't probably learn very much. Because they can just float along in a comfortable state. Because it, you know, if you can get out of these things and kind of, you do. It's times when you're at the end of your tether, there's nowhere to go. You have to face something. There's no way out. That you start developing. You start growing up. You start really understanding life. But in the Four Noble Truths, the teaching of dukkha and the ending of dukkha, I recognize that we're not trying to convince you that everything is dukkha. It isn't like a kind of metaphysical position. You know, we're not absolutizing dukkha, which some people do. Like one person I know was a monk for 6-7 years and did all this Burmese meditation in Rangoon and Masi Sayadaw practices, and where they the very, very strict, very stylized and method of meditation. And it's a very kind of dried up method. There's no devotion in it whatsoever. It's all just kind of this incredibly intense noting and concentrating the mind. And so, and some people love this kind of technique because it's you do this, then you do that, then you do this, then you do that, and it's all kind of laid out for you. And Western people, it's developed from Burmese culture, which is highly devotional. You know, you go, I've never been to Burma, but I hear that it is incredibly devotional. And you go, Burmese that you meet here in Britain are, you know, they've got tremendous devotion culturally instilled in them from toward the Buddha. And so this technique, I think, might be really good for Burmese where they're maybe over the top on devotion, you know, and then to cut through that, just this indulgence in devotion, they develop this very kind of almost sterile technique. So this friend was doing this technique for years, and then he was with one of the great teachers there in Rangoon, and a couple of years ago I met him in San Francisco, and I said, why did you disrobe? And he said, it's too much dukkha. And he said, I just got depressed after a while, all those years contemplating dukkha. And I said, but that's not how it is it? I mean, there is dukkha, but I mean, you know, there's life has a lot of joys in it, and monastic life and all this, it has its very positive side. And he said, well, that wasn't his experience. Even though he was a monk, he lived in this special meditation retreat situation where they just did this method. And the grasping of the idea of dukkha, at least for him, I doubt if the Sayadaws were teaching it this way, but that's how he was picking it up. Well, Westerners might interpret it, and if you just think about everything's dukkha, everything's impermanent, everything dies, everything's dukkha, impermanent, everything dies, it's all unsatisfactory, old age, sickness, death. If you keep kind of reiterating that, you're going to get depressed. Because those are depressing concepts. I mean, if you're grasping those ideas, you just get depressed by them. But recognize it, that's not the Dhamma, not to grasp dukkha, but to use dukkha as a kind of key that gets you in the door. Because it is the most common human experience. We all suffer. Every human being suffers. So, I mean, and it doesn't mean, you know, special kinds of suffering or, you know, extreme forms of suffering. It means just the suffering of, you know, feeling left out when they're passing out the sweets or something. It can be. It can be fairly trivial, but it's still dukkha, you know, and it's still the First Noble Truth. You can still use it. You don't have to wait till, you know, your house burns down and you have cancer and your lover runs off with somebody else, and then this is the dukkha. But the dukkha, see, and then the paradox of it is that understanding dukkha takes you to faith in the noble truths. It gives you, and faith is sadha, there's a strong connection between suffering and faith. So that's why this suffering is not just to be kind of dismissed or ignored and to seek some kind of momentary happiness, but something to understand, because through understanding suffering, then you have the faith, which takes you to the joy and the peacefulness and ultimate realization. So it's not Buddhism is some kind of pessimistic, you know, wet blanket, sour grapes, always suffering. Life is horrible. In my experience with Lungpa Cha, I saw that there's a lot of joy in monastic life, and a lot of you know, because you're contemplating like the goodness that comes to you, the generosity, you're reflecting on what's happening in your life, and you're thinking, here I am, you know, all these people come and offer food so I can practice meditation, I can be a monk, and you're contemplating, you know, the quality of your life, the conventions of your life, and if done in the right way, then one feels the gratitude or joyfulness recognizing the goodness of people around you, the generosity, and these kind of positive reflections come through contemplating your life, not just sitting on a mat and trying to get the jhanas, or just doing a very strict technique, hoping that it's suddenly out of the blue, you're going to be hit by a thunderbolt and you're going to be enlightened forevermore. There's something in all of us that wants to get enlightened quickly and get it over with. And get it all done in 10 easy lessons, and then not have, then live the rest of your life in the state of bliss. But that's not the way it is. The life is this way. There's a lot of pain and enlightened beings still suffer pain and sickness and all the rest. You're not getting out of it. You're not like it doesn't, enlightenment doesn't mean you get out of it. It means you know how to deal with it. You know how not to suffer from the things that happen. And to me, that's much more useful and helpful and inspiring to me than thinking, I want out of this system. I want to go to a place where I'm never going to have pain again, and I'm never going to suffer ever again, and everything is fair and right, and I'm treated properly, and I never have to be frightened of anyone, and never have to experience meanness or unpleasantness, where everything is like the Jehovah's Witness heaven. It is the, where everything is nice and beautiful and fair and just and wonderful. And, you know, that's like a child's paradise, isn't it? You know, where there's mountains are made out of ice cream. And everybody, you know, and the deer come, you can play with the deer, and the lions come and cuddle the lambs, and it's all sweet. That's a kind of fantasy realm we can create. But life is like this. It's hard going. There's a lot of challenges in it. A lot of difficult passages. It's an ordeal. It's tough going living as a human being. but it's the kind that you gain your strength from if you know how to relate to it, how to work with it. You know, like a child that's just spoiled, you know, where the mother just wants to, I don't want my darling ever to suffer, and I don't want my little darling ever to experience pain or sickness. I just want my little darling to live in a realm where he or she is just, everything is nice and protected for them. And little darling grows up and doesn't know how to, you know, collapses. The first somebody looks at them cross-eyed, they just collapse in total, you know, anguish, because they don't know how to relate to the toughness of life. They've been too protected. There's a story about a butterfly. They saw this butterfly trying to break out of it. It wasn't a butterfly yet, but it was in that state where it was breaking out of its cocoon, struggling desperately to get out, and struggle. This person, oh poor thing, I'll help, and helped the break off the cocoon. The butterfly got out, but it didn't have any strength and collapsed and died. So, I mean, it's the struggle. We need the struggle. We need, like, on a meditation retreat, it's good that you have to struggle with yourself, because you have to, you know, that struggling, that kind of using the situation to struggle and to learn how to do things maybe you don't feel like doing, or enduring something that you're tired of or fed up with, or just, you know, staying when you want to run away, or keeping silent when you want to talk. And all this kind of thing is good training for us. It gives us a sharpness that we don't have if life is just, you know, following the easy way out and seeking just comfort and pleasure.
Skilled by struggling, though you could be struggling hard and doing it wrong, whatever. I mean, not that, really. I'm that seeing the people who want to write children, they grasp the pencil like a weapon, you know, to try to do it well. And the more they try, the harder it
Right, but that the struggle needs to be combined with wisdom and reflection, sati. Because at first we do it maybe all wrong. We try too hard. But then we reflect on, you know, you can do it, you don't need to do it that way. You know, like there's a subtlety, like in developing samadhi, it's a subtlety of the mind, isn't it? You can't just will it like that. Samadhi. There's no way, you know, the more willful you are, the less, you know, you just get a headache. Your head bursts. So it's, and yet we all started out doing that. I remember, you know, sort of like this, learning to concentrate on my breath and getting a headache from it. And just feeling so frustrated. I got to hate mindfulness of the breath because I was just so willful, you know, and pushy, and it just didn't work. No way could I concentrate my mind through that kind of willful approach. And yet I had to do it that way. That's the only way I knew how to start. That's how you had to start. I was a coarse person. I had to start from being coarse before I could to realize this, more the subtleties of, and find better ways of dealing with things. So, I mean, it's not that, you know, that's where this reflection, we watch and see what works and we acknowledge, not judge. We're not saying I'm a willful person. I mean, sometimes we put too much effort. We try too hard, or we're pushing too hard or something that needs a subtle movement of the mind. Like in developing the five indriya, the faith and wisdom and the effort and concentration with sati, with mindfulness, there's a subtle balance all between those, between sadha and panya and virya and samadhi, and that you only realize through mindfulness, through reflection on it. Because you can't make yourself have faith or as an act of will. There's no wisdom if you think I'm gonna have faith in the Dhamma. You know, then the wisdom comes really through realizing that faith isn't something you can will yourself into having. Or the virya or effort isn't just bloody-minded effort, not just, you know, willful pushiness, but it's the right amount of effort. That's where you take sati. Now, what the amount of effort you need to sustain, to bring your attention to the nostrils, and sustain and hold your attention on just the inhalation, exhalation. If it's too much, you can't sustain it. Like some effort, like I say, lifting a log onto a lorry, you need to put forth enormous effort to just lift something very heavy and put it somewhere else. But you can't sustain that effort. Is that kind of effort good for just doing something in a moment? You just need it for that kind of activity. But the kind of effort for in this to balance with the concentration is sustainable effort, effortless effort. It's a balance. So it becomes balance rather than extremity. Balance with the concentration.